On this podcast, we've got a special guest, one of our partners, a financial advisor partner of the White Coat Investor here, Clint Gossage, who is a CFA, CFP, and a CPA, and happens to be married to a surgical oncologist for the last 15 years. So he's experienced firsthand the ups and downs on the journey from undergrad to becoming an attending, and realized after helping friends in medical school, residency, and fellowship with their finances, he left a high-paying job where he was managing investments at a multi-billion dollar family office to basically start advising docs. And he's been helping docs and other medical professionals ever since to get out of student loan debt and save money and invest in tax-efficient strategies and manage and protect their assets. What he really likes doing, though, is giving them back their time, which is really our most scarce resource in life. He's actually local to Scottsdale, Arizona, but like all of our recommended advisors that you can find at the White Coat Investor, he will work with you all over the country via phone, email, or video conference. You can find him at cmgfin.com or just email him at cgossage@cmgfin.com or call him at 480-695-8004. Clint, welcome to the White Coat Investor Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. We're going to do a few things. We're just going to talk for a minute about your practice, and then we're going to take some reader questions together and just have this be a short segment as part of our podcast today. So what was it that drove you to become a financial advisor in the first place?
Okay, sure. So I was always the type of kid that liked numbers and was into math competitions and things like that. And going to college, I was looking for a way to put those skills to use. So after I ruled out engineering, finance and accounting made a lot of sense to me, but it wasn't really interested in personal finance or financial planning at all until finance became personal to me, I guess. So I'll leave out some of the details of this story because I'm sure my mom will want to post a link to this episode on her Facebook page. But growing up, I never really felt the pressures of money within our family. I grew up in a small town in Kansas with two brothers and a sister on 10 acres of land. We always had plenty of food on the table, but it wasn't a luxurious lifestyle by any means. We had a saying in our family, once a car hits 100,000 miles, it still has 2/3 of its life left. But it definitely wasn't a childhood where we ever worried about money. And then once I graduated college, though, I realized it was the big stressor in my parents' lives and something that my parents fell asleep worrying about, woke up worrying about. And it was at that point I realized that finance wasn't just percentages and spreadsheets, but it really impacts people's lives. And that's when I decided I could use this to make a difference. So in my early 20s, my parents kind of became my first planning clients.
That's pretty cool. You know, and it obviously means more when it's somebody that you obviously care very much about. Now, you have some impressive financial designations, not only a CFP, which lots of advisors have, but also a CFA, a chartered financial analyst, and you're a certified public accountant. Do you think those were worth getting? Should people be using advisors that don't have all those credentials? I mean, what do you think the value of that's been to you in your practice?
Well, it's definitely been worth it to me as far as having an education level there and an education base there. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of time that goes into studying for those, particularly the three CFA exams, but it's still nothing really compared to the time that goes into medical school or residency or something like that. So I don't want to sit here and pat myself on the back too much. But I'm the type of person that doesn't feel comfortable giving advice on a topic until I've researched it to death, which is good when I'm doing a deep dive into student loan analysis, but maybe not as great when my wife just wants me to pick out a washer and dryer. You know, should people use advisors that don't have these? I think you wrote a good article on this a few years ago about the big problem in our industry and that it's not very regulated as far as the barrier to entry. So you don't need a college education to get into being an advisor, and most can pass a series 7 exam within a week of studying. For that reason, I'd say it's a good rule of thumb that an advisor have at least one of the three, because ultimately the reason to use an advisor is for the advice. So while certifications alone don't guarantee a good advisor, if an advisor has one of the big three, at least you know they put in some work to educate themselves first.
Yeah. Now, what do you see that's unique about your company, your practice?
So I've never been the type of person that could be a good salesman. I remember when I launched my firm, I tried the sales act with a potential prospect, and I came away from it hating the meeting and could tell the prospect was really turned off as well. And I decided at that time I would never try something like that again. And that was kind of a period of reflection when I looked back and realized the whole reason I started this firm was to as a favor to help our friends out with student loan and tax issues while my wife was in residency. And so that's something I try to stay centered on and carry over in everything that we do. It's not really about selling. It's about starting from a place of adding value, making a difference, and truly doing what's in the best interest of our clients and help eliminate the issues that are causing them stress.
Now, what's your fee structure and how do you decide on that?
So that's a good question. I don't think there's a perfect fee structure out there, but ultimately I wanted our fees to be fair to clients and easy to understand. So that's why I ended up using a flat fee structure. It has three different tiers, which is probably a little more complex than I would like, but it's easy to understand because you're paying a flat monthly amount. It's transparent. So you're paying it using a credit card or a debit card. It's not just getting deducted from your account and you don't even know what kind of fee you're paying. And it doesn't keep increasing forever like a typical AUM fee would.
All right. Well, let's take a few questions together from the listeners. First, this one comes in by email from a physician assistant. He actually asked for this to be answered on the podcast, but didn't mention if he wanted to stay anonymous or not. So I'm just going to leave him anonymous. But it's actually one of the most common questions I ever get about paying off debt versus investing. He says, I'm a current emergency medicine PA. Although I'm not an MD-DO, I have gained a great perspective on managing my finances. So thank you. My wife and I are currently deciding what to do moving forward with our financial plans. We're both 27, have a combined annual income of around 160, and still owe 220 in student loans, which I recently refinanced with Laurel Road at 4.25%, and then have my wife's loans, about 50,000 of that at 3.2 fixed. We currently rent for 920 a month and keep our expenses fairly low at around 36,000. I contribute the max to my employer-sponsored 401k plus profit sharing for nearly $35,000 a year into the 401k. My wife contributes the max for her employer match of around $3,000 a year for her 401k. I do have an HSA as well that only my employer is contributing to. I've not yet opened a Roth IRA. My question is, do you think it would be worth it to max out my HSA and Roth IRA contributions and allow that money to grow, or to take that same $9,500 a year and put it toward our student loans? It seems wiser to max out the retirement accounts, but I hate looking at the interest I'm paying my student loans. What do you think? What would you advise this PA?
Yeah, so I know this is a common question for you, and it's probably the most common question I see as well, which is essentially, should I prioritize paying off debt or investing? In this case, they've already refied their student loans at low rates, which definitely gives them some more options. So I think our priority list looks like this. So taking advantage of any employer match on their 401k, which they're already doing and is great. And then also prioritize any of their investment accounts that are getting tax benefits. So that's going to include their Roth and their HSAs as well. And we're really trying to understand, okay, what's going to be the highest and best use of their money. And so with tax advantage accounts, we're hoping over the long term, those are going to be earning 7 to 8%. And they're going to be growing tax-free over that period. And compare that to a potential payback on a student loan, which is earning, you know, 3.25, 4.25. I think that's a good trade-off.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, this is something that, you know, I get this reputation as being totally anti-debt. And I'm not a big fan of debt by any means. But I'm also a huge fan of tax-advantaged investing accounts. You know, it's one thing to be comparing paying off a 4% something debt in your versus your taxable account. It's entirely different in your Roth IRA or HSA, something that's probably never going to be taxed again. So I think there's just you need a little bit higher barrier there. That doesn't mean carry around debt at 10 or 15% in order to max out your Roth IRA, but at 3 or 4%, you know, that's not a bad gamble there. All right, let's take a couple of questions off the SpeakPipe. Remember, you can record questions for us on the SpeakPipe at www.speakpipe.com/whitecoatinvestor. You can be as anonymous as you want on those. And this is our first question, this one coming from an anonymous listener.
Hey, Jim, quick question for you regarding mutual fund versus ETF fees. I commonly use the TD Ameritrade website to compare prospective investments. I've noticed when comparing different share classes of the same investment, the hypothetical fees that TD Ameritrade quotes will vary substantially despite a nearly identical expense ratio. For example, take the comparison between VTSAX and VTI, which, as you know, are different share classes of the same Vanguard Total Market Index Fund. The VTSAX expense ratio is 0.04% and the VTI's is 0.03%. This difference would theoretically translate to a yearly fee difference of $1 per $10,000 invested. When you compare these funds on the TD Ameritrade website, however, they give a five-year total fee estimate of 1.41% for VTSAX and 0.28% for VTI. They calculate these hypothetical fees using the same initial investment, yearly investments, and rate of return over 5 years for both funds. Is there something I'm missing here? Are there hidden fees in the mutual fund share class that aren't reflected in the expense ratio? Is there an error on the TD Ameritrade website? Thanks so much for your input on this.
And they're basically asking, why are the fees different for the mutual fund version of the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund, VTSAX, versus the ETF version, which is VTI at TD Ameritrade? And you want to take that one, Clint?
Sure. So that's a good question. So on TD Ameritrade's site, they include commissions in the way they do their fee comparison when you're comparing mutual funds and ETFs. And TD's using their commission schedule to make that comparison. So how TD charges their ETFs, they do $6.95 per trade, and they charge $49.99 per trade on the mutual funds, which is quite a bit higher. So that's why you're seeing that big disparity there. So when looking at that and trying to really compare the fees, if you're not using TD as your brokerage and you're buying them at Vanguard or something like that, you can basically just look at the expense ratio on the two of them. If you are looking to buy them at TD, obviously VTI or the ETF is going to make a lot more sense.
Yeah, and this has happened to me a lot, actually, in my career with various 401ks and whatever. Like my 401ks at Schwab. And I basically have brokerage window there, and I buy the ETFs because the commissions are lower, and that's the only reason. Whereas when I'm buying them at Vanguard, even in my taxable account, a lot of times I just use the mutual fund version because I happen to prefer mutual funds rather than dealing with having to put in the trade orders during the day. But if you're going to charge me $50 every time I do a transaction, well, shoot, I'll deal with the hassle and I'll just buy the ETFs. And I think that's the difference that they're seeing here. You know, what's interesting, though, is every brokerage is a little bit different in this respect. I was actually corrected recently on, I had mentioned that there were higher transaction fees at E-Trade as well for Vanguard mutual funds, and I was wrong about that. It wasn't true. They actually have the Vanguard mutual funds on their no transaction fee list, and so you could have used either one there at E-Trade, but at TD Ameritrade, they're not super happy with Vanguard right now, or vice versa. I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but in 2017, they took the Vanguard ETFs off their commission-free list, and obviously they're charging the full price for the mutual funds as well, probably because Vanguard won't pay to play with them. All right, our next question comes from Caleb, a military dentist who's got large unrealized gains in his individual stocks. Let's listen to that question.
Hello, I'm a military dentist who graduated dental school in 2006. I have about $1.6 million in a brokerage taxable account and another $300,000 or so in a Roth TSP account between my wife and I. The brokerage account is up approximately $600,000 in unrealized gains. Most of the holdings within the brokerage account are individual stocks. Many of these were purchased well before I started listening to your podcast. I'm wondering if there's a tax-efficient way to transfer some of the individual stocks into index funds, bonds, ETFs, other various less risky investments. Thank you, and have a great day.
So he's basically asking how to move from all these individual stocks to index funds in a tax-efficient way. What would you advise him in that sort of a scenario?
He's done a great job saving up a good chunk of money in individual stocks at this point. And it's really a question of looking to reduce risk. And there's several different options to look at when trying to diversify away. And it's somewhat going to depend on the specifics, probably on the number of individual stocks. If he has 40 or 50, it's going to be a little different than if he has 5 or 6. Okay. But the more holdings he has, the closer he is to a well-diversified portfolio. But first thing I do is turn off any automatic dividend reinvestments. So that way he's not adding to his individual stock portfolio each month or each quarter. Secondly, harvest any losses. So that's going to involve selling any of the stocks that have losses. And he probably wants to look even at the individual lot level meaning if he had bought some Apple stock every year, some of it might have a loss wipe, others, you know, shares of it might have a long-term gain. But by doing that, then he'll generate some losses that he could potentially use to offset some of the long-term capital gains that he's built up. And he'll also want to sell any holdings that have smaller gains and start building up a cash pile that he can start using to start the process of diversifying away from his current individual stocks. The other thing to consider is if he's charitably inclined, he may want to give away some of the appreciated stock. So he can deduct that at its full market value and doesn't have to pay any of the gains. So that's a great option. Or if he has an estate plan and wants to leave potentially an amount to an heir or heirs, then he can get a step up a basis on his taxes once he finally decides to go through that process. Really, if we're looking at, you know, all those options have been exhausted. As a military dentist, I don't exactly know what he makes, but I'm guessing he's in the 15% long-term capital gain tax bracket. So it wouldn't be the biggest deal to sell at least up to the point that he's not going to trigger going up and paying, you know, 18.8 after the Medicare surtax. As long as he's still within that 15% AGI threshold, I would look at starting to sell off a portion and generating some of those long-term capital gains as part of his year-end tax planning. But he probably want to coordinate that with the CPA.
I think that's great advice. You know, when I began helping my parents with their portfolio, they had a whole bunch of individual stocks that somebody had been picking for them. They're terribly underperforming an index fund. And most important thing for their portfolio was to get into good investments as soon as possible. But they were lucky. All their money was in an IRA. So I could just sell them all. I just put in all the sell orders. And then by the end of the day, I'd bought index funds with them. It was very, very straightforward because there were no tax consequences. But that's not the case for Caleb, is it? It's, you know, a lot more complicated. It's easy for, you know, to turn off the dividends. It's easy to sell all the losers. It's easy to sell everything with minimal gains. And then you're stuck looking at it going, do I build my portfolio around this thing with a large capital gain? Or do I bite the bullet and pay the taxes now instead of paying more, even more taxes later? And so I think it's a difficult dilemma for people that have done this.
I think it is too. And I think it's, you know, you don't want to just let the taxes drive the whole decision there just because there's so much risk in individual stocks. I mean, a stock can lose all of its value within in a given year. So it's pretty easy to make up for a 15 to 20% tax loss in, you know, one bad earnings month for an individual stock.
Yeah, that's a good point for sure that the risk is significant and you can't let the tax tail wag the investment dog.
For sure.
Well, thank you so much, Clint, for being on the podcast. If you have further questions for him, you can find him at https://cmgfin.com. And he can answer further questions there. Or if you're looking for a good financial advisor, he can certainly provide you good advice at a fair price. Thanks again, Clint.
Thanks, and thanks for having me on the podcast.